So, Brad, when I was a grad student in England, my wife was also a grad student in England. She was going to school in London at the University of London. I was going to school down in Canterbury at the University of Kent. They had, believe it or not, a cartoon and caricature studies museum and center at that university. It was a repository for all their World War I, World War II cartooning, right? So I did my master's degree there because I was doing my master's on World War II propaganda. It was a perfect place. Anyway, long story short, my wife had a London flat. I had a Canterbury flat. So it was like city mouse and country mouse, you know? So I would go up to visit her anytime we wanted to go see a play or go to a, you know, truly big cultural event. She would come down to Canterbury anytime she wanted to, see a mouse. And so we would.
I mean, what we're calling it?
Once you've seen the cathedral, you're like, all right, what else is? Actually, I should say this: Canterbury had the highest pubs to person ratio in all of England, which was as a college student, chef's kiss good. It was delightful. Yeah,
yeah, no kidding.
You had your pick of every kind of pub you can imagine. Anyway. The story I wanted to tell you, though, was there was a time where I went up to visit her in London for a 3 or 4 day weekend. I was like, oh, got to get back to class. You know what, Glo? I'll take the late train back from London to Canterbury. And you know what? Yes, I will have a pint or two of Guinness before I get on the train. That sounds lovely. It's 11 o'clock.
So far, it sounds like perfect planning.
It's 11 o'clock at night. I'm an adult. I'm going to have a pint of Guinness. I have a pint of Guinness or two, and I get on the train. And I'm like, all right, here we go. We're off to Canterbury. And then, Brad, I proceed to fall deathly asleep, out cold. Yeah. It had been a weekend of going and moving and doing and walking around, seeing plays in London, doing the museums, all sorts of stuff. I get on this train. I fall right asleep. I wake up to the screech of, because England, I love England so much, but bless them, they still have super old trains. I wake up to the screech of train brakes that are from 1940, like just the oldest train brakes in the world. And the train rattles to a stop. And then I get a nudge on the shoulder. Right, come on, mate. So I'm gonna, and the guy's nudging me to get off the train. And I go, oh, no, I'm not due till Canterbury. He goes, Canterbury? That was 10 stops ago. We're in Margate. And I go, Margate? Oh, no. Margate, just so you know, is a coastal town. It's way on the coast of southeastern England. I had fallen asleep, went right through Canterbury. It was, I'm not kidding, like 3 in the morning. And I was in Margate, which is a sleepy little coastal town, which, in summers in the Victorian age, the English would go down there for like a summer beach vacation. But beaches in England are terrible. But this was not summer. This was not summer. This was January. It was 3 in the morning and it was raining. And he goes, all right, you got to get off the train. And I go, where do I go? And he goes, I have to tell you, mate, it is not the problem of the British train service where you go. And so I get off the train and I'm like, what do I do? I'm 21, 20 years old, something like this. I didn't have many pounds in my pocket. I had like 5 pounds in my pocket. And I also, in general, I didn't have many pounds to my name. I was a college student. I had a terrible job working in the cartoon museum. Anyway, so I didn't have like a credit card that I could go get a hotel room. Also, it's a tiny town. It's January. They're not open. Nobody's open.
Right.
So I literally slept in a bus awning until the town woke up at like 7 or so. And I was like, well, I guess I'll get back to Canterbury now. Just dummy McGee sleeping down in Margate in the rain on a bus terminals bench. By myself, just like, I've done a dumb thing. I'm not that bright.
Wow, that's horrible. And again, this is pre-credit cards and stuff. So it's not like you could just duck in and get breakfast and while away the morning. I screwed up. You got nothing.
Well, I had a credit card and it was more of a debit card, but I had a card. I could have done something, but I can't emphasize enough, like, imagine a small, like, I'm going to put it in terms that Brad can understand, a small Michigan vacation town that in the winter shuts down. Like, there's nobody there. That's what Margate is in winter. There's like 3 old ladies that come out at like 10 a.m. and then now the town is open, right? You know? So there was nowhere to go. There was no room in the inn for Dave Kellett at that morning. I was like, I got no choices. It's either I sleep in this bush or I sleep on this bus bench. There's the two places I could sleep.
Now, how bizarre was the train ride back? going past all of these stops, knowing full well that if you would have woken up at any one of those stops, you would have been better off than Margate.
Oh, it's so humbling. It's so humbling to go through. Yeah. Well, I missed this stop and I missed this stop and I missed this stop and I missed it. Just like train stop after train stop where like I could have conceivably caught a train back. Because by the way, I think I implied, but I didn't actually mention it. It was the end of service. Like it was 3 a.m. They were not going to run another train from Margate to London.
Done. Like they're it was like, no, we're done. Too.
Next train, my friend, is at 10 a.m. That's a good luck on you. And so I spent my morning at Margate. I had the most embarrassed English breakfast and then made my way back to Canterbury and dried myself out. And on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about embarrassingly miss your train and making comics.
And Roy, you got to get off here now, mate. That's the best British I can
do. I felt like I was transported back. That was note perfect. I have no notes. No notes.
And making a living from comics, I'm Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his pal, Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of the comics documentary Stripped.
And this week's hour of comics advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. And we would be remiss to jump right in without mentioning our good friends over at Wacom at WACOM.com. Why are you so revelatorily smiling?
Remiss indeed. We are so thrilled to have our sponsors back at Wacom. And we love talking about the Wacom One. Number one, because it's a high quality professional device. And number two, because it's just so darn practical. And what's the word I'm looking for? Movable, portable.
This is how good it is. Both Brad and I use it on a regular basis, to produce our art. That's how perfect this partnership is with Wacom and sponsoring this podcast is. I feel it's like, Brad, if the company Water had come to us and said, hey, you two, how do you feel about water? Are you OK endorsing water? And Brad are like, are we OK endorsing water? The Wacom, I have two Wacoms now in use in our studio. The Wacom one that Beth uses for her coloring, and mine is the Wacom Cintiq 24 Pro I use for my drawing. I love them both, and they have become integral to my business, to my art. And I honestly, ask yourself this, Brad, what would you do without your Wacom if it suddenly snapped its way out of your universe?
Oh my gosh, I would get a lot less work done. I would get less work done at home, and I would get less work done when I'm out and about trying to squeeze in a little bit of time. Like if I'm taking a trip with the family, you know, and you've always got a couple hours here and there where you can get a little something done. It's perfect for when you want to just take something that's very portable yet high quality and get the job done.
It's funny you should mention that because I went to go visit Gloria on her production. She's doing a shoot out in Malibu and I brought the Wacom One with the laptop. It's great to be able to do like just a quick hour of work to stuff it back in the bag. Yeah. And you don't feel as guilty as a cartoonist going to do a family event or going to do, you know, because we're always like, I gotta be working, should be working, gotta be working.
Yeah.
And that is the note perfect thing to bring along with you. So we give a huge shout out and a thanks to our friends Wacom over at WACOM.com, the makers of the Wacom One. And Bradley, what do we got on the agenda for today?
We got a lot of stuff on the agenda, but I got my own agenda. I want to talk about something that is absolutely has me tickled pink. And that is I just saw a good friend of mine achieve a Kickstarter goal in the first 7 hours. And I'm thrilled to see this kind of success. And I'd like to talk about that.
Oh, yeah, I'm very excited. So we had mentioned it on previous shows.
Oh, did you do well on your Kickstarter, too?
Unnecessary. Unnecessary. Oh, I see. Did Scott have a Kickstarter launching right now?
Enough about Carl Kershaw. Let's talk about Drive.
Oh, you delightful son of a bitch. All right. So, yes, I launched my Kickstarter. Now, as folks listening at home might remember, the way my strategy with a lot of my Kickstarters is I secretly launch to my Patreon backers first, and then I don't make the link public. I don't announce it. I don't do any marketing. I just do it to Patreon. And I usually have some sort of exclusive just for Patreon in those first 18 hours. So I'll launch at 2 p.m. Pacific time. And then 8 a.m. the following morning, this morning, about 15 minutes ago, I bring the link live to the world. So now I just tweeted about it. When we get done with this podcasting, I will go down through my long list of marketing locations, my blogs, this blog, that blog, past Kickstarters, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, long story short, this first 18 hours with just Patreon was the best that I have ever had of any pod. I've done, I think, 15 Kickstarters now, I think, Brad.
Yeah.
And no, maybe it's more like 10. 10. I've done 10 Kickstarters now. And this by far was the best launch out of the gate I've ever had. The goal was 45,000, and we made that in 4 hours. And then at the 18 hour point, as far as I checked, we were at 55,000, I think, as of right now. So I am over the moon. I don't know what to do with myself. This is such a delightful launch. Like my dream Kickstarter, Brad, let me actually pitch you on this. My dream Kickstarter is everyone just decides on the first day, you know what? Yes, I am going to back this. I'll just back it on the first day. And then you're done. Then you don't have to do all the rigmarole for 30 days.
You can
just be like, oh, everyone jumped in. Great. All right. We'll wrap it up. We'll go radio silent now. But anyway, and so this is the closest I've ever gotten to that is I think it's about a third of the eventual backers jumped in within the first 18 hours, which is lovely. Oh. It's really lovely.
That feels great. And also by getting your goal so early and having such a huge opening day start, you know that that's going to kickstart the Kickstarter algorithm to make sure that they're presenting you over the next 30 days much more often, right?
Yeah, like I would think that you would probably find it. It hasn't happened yet, but you'll probably find it in the sort of project we loved category, which is the staff.
In fact,
pick,
I was just looking. That's what I was clicking around here looking for because I was expecting it there, and I'm sure it's going to end up there pretty soon. A little bit much to expect it on the very first day, but
I don't. But also, you're right though that the algorithms will kick in, and actually, that is it's a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy if you can have that happen. In that, because you're doing well, Kickstarter puts it towards the top of its algorithms, and then it does better. And then it's it's sort of a snake that eats itself at that point. It's just doing great because it's doing great. And so that's lovely. So the hope for now with the Kickstarter that's doing this well is to not only reach my original sort of back of envelope math goal, but also to bring in new readers via Kickstarter, which is something that's rare and wonderful, where people are like, you know what? Wow, this seems to be doing good. People seem to like this. I like sci-fi. I will give this a try, that kind of thing. And so if I can hope for that, that would be the best of all worlds, I think, in this case.
That's almost t-shirtable. I like sci-fi. I'll give this a try. It's very Dr. Seuss.
Why? I like sci-fi. Oh, my. The way that I think I'm anticipating your next question, the way I got the Patreon folks to jump in bigger on this Kickstarter, and it's actually worth talking about for this show because this is a fairly new feature for Kickstarter, was I used add-ons. Now, we talked about this in passing, that add-ons are a version of what BackerKit does for Kickstarter. It's not the exact same, but if you know what BackerKit does, where like Brad, let's say Brad says, I'm back in the hardcover book. I'm getting the hardcover book. Great. All right. The Kickstarter is over. Now BackerKit would offer Brad the opportunity to get a Sheldon pin or a drive poster or something like that and throw it into his cart before he quote unquote checks out. Right.
Yeah.
But what Kickstarter does now is they say, okay, you've got all these tiers. You can set them up best possible way to set them up, bada bing, bada boom. But now on the follow-up page, you can add in eBooks, you can add in prints, you could add in pins or magnets or smaller kind of tchotchke type items that, if you get enough of them, they help the overall rising tide of that Kickstarter and help you get to your goal. And so what I did with Patreon is there is a series of three prints that will be eventually $10. In the Kickstarter, that when the Patreon folks jumped in, they will be $1, but only in that first 18 hours. And my idea there is that it's a loss leader both to say thank you for their Patreon support, because Drive does have considerable Patreon support, but also it, as we talked about, it juices that algorithm. It gets us to the goal all that much faster, and it gets it risen up in all sorts of different rankings on Kickstarter.
And also, here's what else it does. It it doesn't do something that's very important. It doesn't add a whole lot to the weight of the item that you're shipping.
No, the sort of golden item in any Kickstarter is the flat packable item that weighs next to nothing. Yeah. That frankly, when you print more of it, the cost goes down. So the fact that I'm giving these out for a dollar to Patreon folks, I've immediately juiced my print run by, I don't know, 400, 500. And so now my cost has come down by tens of pennies from an already not very expensive level. So it helps. It's a virtuous circle. It helps the whole thing happen all the better, you know?
Yep. And just for anybody who's a little bit younger, maybe hasn't started their first Kickstarter, this is something that I just want to underline before we move on to the next topic. And that is, here's something else that did not happen. Dave did not give his Patreon backers a free copy of the book, right? Oh, yeah, we always tell people, Patreon is Patreon, Kickstarter is Kickstarter. And not only a Patreon backer at the end of the day does not expect a free Kickstarter reward, but they are the first people who are thrilled to jump over and become a Kickstarter backer, and vice versa. Kickstarter backers end up in a lot of times discovering your Patreon and they're like, oh, this is great. I'm going to jump over and be a Patreon backer. But every now and again, I'll see somebody offering like a free book through Patreon when it's kickstarted, and that's not a great strategy.
You're much better
realizing that those are the people who are super big fans of yours, and they are thrilled to do both.
Absolutely. I really underline that point from Brad. Do not give away the book for free. In the same way that Patreon is paying for the community, paying for the access, paying for the exclusives and the sneak peeks and the early reads, all that sort of stuff, right? That is a, for lack of a better phrase, an access payment. Kickstarter is a product payment. They're paying for the thing that is the result of all that work. But you got to keep those separate. And frankly, the people that support you are happy to support you. And so shake off that imposter syndrome that says you have to give things away for free in your Kickstarter. It is not the case. But one thing, by the time this show airs, Brad, I think I have my math right. The Kickstarter will already be ended. So everyone can go look and see how I did because we're that far ahead in the recording. So
We might be. Yeah.
Future Dave and Brad will be listening to this going like, well, let's go click over and see how he did. But if I play my cards right, one thing you'll see with the Drive Kickstarter that I do fairly well is I start to gamify it with the stretch goals. So not everything is a monetary stretch goal. And this, I have to give credit to Matt Inman of the Oatmeal Forward. This is who I learned it for. In terms of keeping our heads on a swivel and watching our peers, Matt Inman gamifies his Kickstarters really well, where some things are unlocked. Like, I think I'm going to unlock the dust jacket or the built-in ribbon bookmark by I need 20 people to build Lego drive ships. Right. Like, that's just fun. That benefits no one in the sense that it's just the community having fun with itself. We're going to build ships out of Legos, and then you got to submit the photos. And then I do another goal where if we get 10 people cosplaying from Drive, then we unlock another stretch goal, right? Like, that kind of stuff is fun.
That's so
wonderful.
It's
just pure fun. And it also reminds people that it's not just about money.
And it gives you something to talk about on social media other than, hey, I'm doing a Kickstarter. And over the next 30 days, you're going to get so tired of hearing yourself talk about this Kickstarter, but it's going to be important that you keep doing it because, again, the algorithm is making sure that not everybody is seeing that message.
Yep.
People have to hear a message 7 times before they act. All of those things we've talked about on the podcast before.
Right.
It's going to be so beneficial for you to have something that's related and fun that you can talk about this Kickstarter with.
Absolutely. I mean, the sweetest platonic ideal is to have something new to talk about with a Kickstarter every 2 to 3 days, you know, where you're not just beating the same drum because, frankly, you're going to hate your own voice at the end of 30 days.
Yeah.
And you're going to think like, there's nothing new here. I'm trying to make, a chair out of sawdust. I can't do this anymore. And so when you have new things to talk about, it just it advances the conversation. It gets people churned up in new and different ways. So anyway, go see how I did over at newdrivebook.com and see whether I fell flat on my face or whether we stuck the landing. By the time this show is out, it'll be interesting to see.
Ah, fantastic. I'm going to be watching very closely. In the meantime, we've got a couple questions from Patreon backers I'm going to pair these two because they're so similar and they talk about similar things.
Okay.
I'm just going to give them both to you at the same time and you can take them in whatever order. The first one comes in from Raj Solanki, who says, "Hi, Dave and Brad, you often give the advice to work on your writing because a good story is what keeps an audience. I completely agree. Do you have tips or exercises for one to improve? How does one improve at writing?" And I'm going to pair that with this one that came in anonymously. "While I am sure that I have found my style as an artist, I don't feel the same way about my voice as a writer. I'm close, but not quite there yet. Looking back at your career, what moments helped you to find your voice?" So we're going to talk about writing in the next segment here, how to get better and a little bit more nuanced. How does one find one's voice?
Okay, well, which one would you like me to tackle first, Brad? Do you have a plan of attack that you would like to go with?
Let's take them in 1-2 order. Let's talk about improving first.
Okay, so for improving your writing, it's much like improving your palate in some respects. Like my brother-in-law trained to be a sommelier with wine, and they were always like, you got to stop eating sugar. You got to focus on good foods, natural foods. And by that virtue, your palate will get better and you'll be able to taste a better discernment of unique foods and all that sort of stuff. And
really?
By the way, your face lit up as soon as I mentioned wine. This is a topic that has never gotten such a reaction out of Brad. Suddenly he's leaning forward. He's focused.
Yes.
He's cleaning his glasses so he can get a better look at me all of a sudden.
You're not wrong, but I've never heard about the fact that you can't have junk food and like wine. I've done both of them quite proficiently.
Yes, Brad, but your wine comes in a box and that's one discerning.
You're not wrong. I am a strong advocate of box wine. I know you're kidding, but I am serious as a heart attack.
So when the good folks at Gallo are literally using a snow shovel to scrape the bottom of that barrel out, they're like, "This is going to Brad Gagger. That boy in Philadelphia, he love his box wine. We're just going to scrape this. Oh, look at these old grapes at the bottom. We'll just throw that in the box and send that."
I'm not sure that one's a grape. It's still moving.
Pour some water on that rat and send it to Brad Gagger. That's fine. Apparently with sommeliers, the part of the trick is that the modern diet, the American diet with fast food and a lot of grease, a lot of salt, a lot of sugar, it ruins your palate. And that's why, and sometimes with dieting, it's so hard to break that because your body is starting to crave that. It's become this bad cycle of, and so anyway, with some, I don't know how did we get on sommeliers? What was even the question?
You're going to bring it writing. Back eventually to writing. I'm confident in this. You're going to bring it back to writing.
I'm going to Mary Lou Retton this. I'm going to stick this landing. Okay, here we go.
My God.
Okay. So here we go. Much like a sommelier with wine. Stop it. Oh God. God damn, stop laughing. Much like a sommelier with wine, in terms of surrounding yourself with quality and being able to better discern quality, the more you read, the better you will become as a writer. And the more you read writers of quality, the better you'll be able to write with quality. You know, like if you're reading, in my case, I've been diving into really good classic sci-fi. And you get a better sense of how pacing, structure, story, character, arcs, how all of it works and flows from the hands of a master. And you go, even if you're being humble about it, you'd be like, well, I'll never be them, but I can learn from them. And the more that you read, the more that you learn, you pick up a tidbit from this author, from that author, from this person, that person, and you start to roll it in. Brad, what are your thoughts on that first idea?
Oh, well, first of all, I wanted to make fun of that metaphor so badly, but you did it so well, I can't. So I'm disappointed with how well you just wrote that segment of the podcast. You did wonderful, and
the reason I did that so well is I brought in some Brad Gagger box wine here, and I've been helping myself.
But yeah, I was going to say the same thing. To be a better writer, you've got to be a better reader. And also, it's helpful to take some of that me time that you've got where you are kind of semi vegging out and maybe watching a TV show or a movie and tune in just a little bit. And you don't have to like sit there and take notes, but turn some of that enjoyment time into active brain time. I'll give you a good example from my current life. I'm going through the Amazon Prime series, The Boys, which is kind of a modern take on superheroes. Mm-hmm. And not only is it interesting to see how they're parsing superheroes, but just the storytelling structure is so interesting. Even if it was about anything else other than superheroes, I'd be very interested in how they were setting up every story beat. And as a scene is playing out, I'm actively asking myself, why are they telling me this now?
Right.
Why is this important now? How come they didn't go any further? Right. They give me a little bit of a story and then it ends up with, for example, well, somebody saved me from the fire. Well, who was that man? And then something happens and interrupts that moment. You don't get the answer to that question. And then I sit there and think, well, why didn't I get the answer? Why is it important for me to know but not know going into the next moment? Right. And as I see everything unfold, it's like, okay, I can see what they were setting up. And what I'll probably do is watch all of these episodes a second time because now I know what's happening. I can pay attention a lot more. What I'm trying to say is some of that enjoyment time you're spending watching TVs, movies, and reading, you can kind of tune in a little bit and pay attention to how other people did it. Mm-hmm. And then it gives you some ideas on what you can do in your storytelling as well.
Right. Okay. Now here is where the advice needs a next step, because let's take it into another spectrum and you'll see where this falls apart. So if you're saying to me, Dave, I want to be a good guitarist, what do I have to do? And if my only response is to say, you got to listen to Django Reinhardt, you got to listen to Eddie Van Halen, you got to listen to Eric Clapton, and by listening to good guitarists, you will by virtue become a good guitarist. So you already see where this is falling apart. So here's the next step. You have to write, and you have to write with joy all the time. And here's an example. You could just send a text back to a friend or take that as a moment, as a writing exercise of like, I what could I do that goes the next level in my writing in this moment? What can I do in this email that I have to send that puts a little zhuzh on it, puts a little joy into it, puts a little bit of a twist in it, right? So if you come at writing as a joy, you can start to zhuzh up all the writing in your life. And also when you do sit down to write your comics or write long form or whatever it is going to be, you are primed and ready to go because you've been reading good stuff. You've been sprinkling it into your day and now you're ready to go to write and also write with a repetitive practice. So as Brad always says, you can't get worse at something you do every day. If you're setting up a schedule for yourself to succeed so that you're writing once a day, even if it's only for 15, 20 minutes, that's a recipe for success.
Yeah. And I'm going to give you a direction to go. I'm going to co-sign that 100%. If you're looking for some good ways to get started, there's a subreddit called Writing Prompts. That is
great suggestion.
Excellent. In fact, I use it in my storytelling class every day of the semester. We start and I just grab things right from Writing Prompts. And the key to that is not to try and cherry pick a writing prompt that you get excited by. The key is to choose one at random. Choose the first one at the top of the page when you load that page, or to choose one completely on a random basis. The key is not to cherry pick it, to find one that you like. To really become a good writer, you take any one of those, because what's going to happen at that point is you're going to find out that all of writing is problem solving. And you can actually, once you realize, and it's a confidence issue, once you realize that you can solve any problem, you start to gain confidence as a writer, and that's your first step towards becoming a better writer. So I'm going to suggest you go to Writer Prompts every day, and by the way, 15 minutes. I give my students 15 minutes. You can write a story in 15 minutes. It's not going to be, you know, Pride and Prejudice, but it's going to be something that you can look at and then evaluate. Give yourself a little 15-minute writing study every morning on the first writing prompt that you see on that list. I guarantee that you're going to build those skills that's going to make you a better writer.
Yeah. And I, boy, do I underline that, because if you pick the top of upvoted writer's prompts on that subreddit, what you're doing is basically getting what would be a paid community college or college class for free, in the sense that it would take a paid professor a while to come up with writing prompts as good as the ones that you're getting on that subreddit. Some of them are quite literally world-class writing prompts. You're like, wow, who thought of this? This is an amazing prompt. Here's a fun game to do with writer's prompts that I do as well, even though I already have enough writing on my plate, is I will read the prompt and then kind of look away from the screen for about 5 to 10 minutes and see how I would solve that problem. See how I would structure the story in my mind. Even if I don't write it, I take a couple of minutes and I think about how I would do it. And then I read the top one or two upvoted ones and I go, oh, this is a much better way to tackle this problem. Oh, I see. No, they actually turned that on its head. This is a much better approach. Or sometimes, rarer, but sometimes I go, nah, I like my approach better. Mine would have worked out better. But I admit that's rarer, but it does happen. But anyway, by virtue of doing that, you're stretching your muscles, even if I didn't actually get the time. So for example, if you're on a plane flight, if you're on a train ride, if you're on a bus ride, if you're stuck in Margate at 3 a.m. and it's raining and you don't have a hotel to go to, you can play this little game with yourself with writer's prompt, read the prompt, and then mentally write out the story in your head and then compare it to the one that got upvoted the most and see how you did. Brad, that's an excellent suggestion. I do that myself and I hadn't thought to bring it up here.
Absolutely. Here's another one that you can do, and this is a little bit more comics specific. In other words, the first one is good for writing maybe something that we would consider long form, right? I'm going to give you a short form writing exercise, and I'm going to build it into doing something that might help you improve on social media a little bit. Go over to Twitter, open up Twitter, and see what the trending topics are. Choose one trending Twitter hashtag, and in the next 20 minutes, create a cartoon based on that hashtag. Take that subject, whatever it is, and you've got, and this would work best for single panel, because again, the idea is quick. The idea is not to linger over this thing and torture yourself. The idea is to say, boom, I'm going to do this subject 20 minutes, do a sketch, right? Not even I'm going to say the word, Dave, do a doodle. Okay. And, right. But the important thing is that punchline that you've written, that's going to be the thing that takes you the most time, and then post it under that, using that Twitter hashtag, right? The idea being it's trending anyway. This is a good chance for you to get some eyeballs, to flex your muscles a little bit, ride that wave. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a little, positive reinforcement if you do a good job, and you're going to be doing a writing exercise every day. This is another one that if you wanted to get better, I would challenge you to do that every day. 20-minute exercise, do that Twitter trending hashtag.
Awesome. And I will put one last caveat, or not caveat, a capstone on this, because I think this is a fun suggestion too. For folks listening to this podcast, either as a Patreon member or out in the general public, one thing that we offer as an exclusive just to Patreon members over at patreon.com/comiclab is every week we do a second podcast. And very frequently, especially in the last 6 months, we've been doing a podcast called Writer's Room. And here's why I want to mention that, because for those of you that have never written in pairs or written in a room or written in a group, it's a great way to hear how one or two minds, or frankly, just different minds, work through a problem. So it's Brad and I coming to each other with a half form problem or a half of pitch and saying, help me get there. Help me stick this landing. And then the show is about a half an hour of us working through possibilities, variabilities, and even different forms of punchline until we winnow it down to the one that really is solid. And we don't always stick the landing, but it's fun. Yeah. And I frankly do think it's really instructive to hear how two professionals work their way through a problem and try to get to a writing solution.
Absolutely. Now, Dave, I've left this one for second because I got a feeling it's going to be a little bit of a shorter conversation. And that is the question of finding one's voice. How do you find your voice? What moments helped you to find your voice? Let's talk a little bit about finding one's voice as a writer.
Okay, I will talk about a very specific memory that I have that actually helped me become me. And I know that sounds wishy-washy, but I'll tell you what I mean. We were at a Baltimore Comic Con in, I don't even know what year, a good 15 years ago, let's say, right? And it was a whole host of, in fact, I just saw a photo from it the other day, and it's the most delightful black and white photo of you and I and David Malky and Danielle Corsetto and Scott Kurtz. And there's a few other cartoonists there, but it was about 15 other cartoonists sitting around a table having dinner together. And it was just a lovely memory. Anyway, that specific weekend, I was getting to know Scott Kurtz, and he turned to me and what a really insightful comment that actually helped me become a better writer. He said to me, "You are funnier in person than you are in your writing." And now that sounds like an insult. It wasn't said as an insult. It was actually said with love. Mm-hmm. But what it did for me is it gave me a moment and frankly, a couple months of self-evaluation where I went, why? Why? Because I agreed. I was like, why am I funnier in person than I am in my writing? And I think the truth is, all of us, no matter who we are and what background, we tend to not give ourselves permission to be who we truly are in our writing or in different aspects of our life, right? Sometimes it takes until our 30s or 40s until we just say, to heck with it, I'm going to be me. You know, I'm finally going to be me. And Scott saying to me, you're funnier in person than you are in your writing, I realized that I was limiting the way I wrote, limiting and trying to almost like a faux overlay of who I was. You know what I mean? That frankly limited the humor that I brought to it. And so I personally found that to be really eye-opening and helpful on my journey.
You were so busy trying to be who you were supposed to be, you were forgetting to be who you were.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. In some respects, I was, I'll be honest with you that in some respects, and Scott and I have had this conversation many times, I was writing for the cartoonist that I wanted my parents to be proud of. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so, which is fine. It's all well and good. There's nothing wrong with loving your parents and wanting them to be proud of you. But Scott and I have said many a time that as artists, it's going to be interesting when our parents pass, because that will be an interesting moment where, I don't know, it'll be a different moment of creativity when you no longer have your parents in this world. And what will that mean for all of us as creators when that happens? You know, it's just an interesting thing. But it was on all that whole journey of self-discovery was brought on by Scott very rightly and kindly saying, gosh, you're funnier in person than you are in your writing. Why do you suppose that is? And so anyway, that was really helpful for me. But for you, Brad, what was one of the helpful moments for you?
Well, when I've talked about developing one's artistic style in the past, because we've gotten that question before, how do you develop your artistic style? And I've always said that developing one's artistic style is not something you drive to. Rather, it's something that you see in your rearview mirror after you've had a long trip. In other words, it's something that forms as a result of you solving problems over and over and over again. And pretty soon you form good habits. Hopefully they're good habits. You probably form a few bad habits too. And you habitually get to the point where you can kind of guess how you're going to solve the next drawing problem, or at least how you're going to approach it. And I think finding one's voice as a writer is very much the same sort of thing. It's something that you just realize after a long time of writing that that's what happens. I've had a little bit of a difficult journey in terms of finding my writing voice, because for a long time, probably longer than I really should have, especially during Greystone Inn, for the first 4.5 years, I relied very, very heavily on wordplay for humor, right? And got associated with puns, and to even to an extent that, like, I appreciate puns an awful lot, but there's so much of what people call puns that aren't puns, and then immediately anything that is wordplay becomes pun. And there's a difference between a pun and the kind of language examination, for example, that George Carlin did on a regular basis as part of his stand-up. And that's the stuff that really more excited me than a pun. You know what I'm saying?
More wordplay than punnery, yeah.
Yeah, and language examination. And so I've had to kind of walk away from that a little bit and try to kind of break my readers of that expectation that this is going to be a pun in the fourth panel. And it also meant challenging myself to find new ways to solve those writing problems, find new ways of finding the humor, challenging myself to do something that in the Comic Lab Discord server in the writing room, I'm constantly extolling, and that is to push the concept. You're at a one. You need to push to an 8 or a 9. Right. You're at the beginning. And so many people, they want to hold on to that one so hard. And it's like, no, here's the deal. I'm speaking from experience. I know exactly how this feels. I see this because I've been there so often. You gotta, to get to a better point, you gotta push past this. And that's really where my journey has taken me. Do I know what my voice is? I don't know that I don't know that I completely do at this point. I think I'm still on the journey of becoming a better writer. But I can tell you that I wasn't going to get there without challenging myself to do better.
Can I comment for a second about your writing from an outsider in? Because I think it also has an impact on the way I've changed as a writer, which is you and I both started as pure joke writers, pure comic strip writers, set up, punchline, right? That was us for the better part of a decade or a decade and a half, right? And part of us growing into becoming better writers is realizing that the humor matters more in your case when there's a relationship behind it, when there's a romance behind it, when there's stakes behind it, right? And so not everything has to be a joke, because for the joke to really land, you have to build through the romance or build through that relationship or build up to all any of that. And so as a writer, you have improved because you've seen that life, better writing, much like life, requires a seasoning of different things throughout. You can't just constantly be like, bada bing, bada boom, zingo. Hey, take my wife, please. That kind of stuff, you know? And I think that's the same is true with me with Drive, is that I realize that the humor matters more. It lands more because there are stakes and because there's drama and because these characters are imperfect. And that has made for better comics on both of our parts, I think.
It's interesting you mention that, because there's a colliding of two different concepts now that I didn't realize was happening until you pointed it out. I've said on this show many, many times in the past that the four panel comic strip is a really lousy way to tell a story, right? Mm-hmm. There's so many people that still want to do a storyline comic in four panels. And I've said for a long time, listen, that was great for newspapers because of the way that newspapers were delivered to people.
Right.
But it's not a good fit for today's storytelling. And I became a better storytelling artist when I left that four panel structure and started publishing in like a half page, because I literally had more time to work on those relationships. I had more time to build those relationships out than just four panels with that required a punchline in that fourth panel. When I finally left that, all of a sudden my storylines started to take on significance, because I wasn't trying to shoehorn a pun in on the fourth panel.
Can I one up this? I want to yes and this, because I think the comics industry is actually about to go through the same. Because the 30 whatever page floppy was good. You can get a good story out in 30 whatever pages, right? Mm-hmm. But to be fair, when we do experience the death of the floppies, we're going to have better stories, because it's like the same thing that you've discovered going from comic strips to graphic novels, is the when you allow the story to take the space that it needs and the fermentation that it needs in terms of building up the drama, building up the chaos, building up relationships, you will get better stories rather than trying to shoehorn it into a format that was built for a different era. Anyway, that may be a little tangential, but I think it's related, is that I think we're going to get better graphic novels 10 years from now because of that change. Anyway, what a great answer, Brad. I really liked your answer. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
Dave, I think it's time we told them.
We told them? All right, let's tell them.
Oh, I think we got to tell them. I think we've got to tell people that we've got great news. If you remember going into 2020 before the pandemic, we had a really big, exciting personal appearance planned at the Charles Schulz Museum. And although we were very sad that we had to cancel that, it turns out that the nice people at the Charles Schulz Museum are still interested in having us out there to do a live show. And we are going to do it to celebrate the 100th birthday of Charles Schulz.
That's right. We're going to go out for Sparky's 100th birthday, rest his soul. And I think it should be a really good to do. Where they're still working on the planning for it. But how could you not have a big shindig for his 100th birthday? So what's going to be fun is, for Comic Lab listeners, what Brad and I are planning to do, and it's all very nebulous at this point. Plans might change a little bit because we're far enough out. But the plan is we're going to do a live podcast at the museum's auditorium that night. But either that afternoon or the following day, we are going to do a Patreon group tour of the museum. And they seemed very excited about that, it would be a big gaggle of cartoonists. Brad and I imagine one of their, what do you call the people at a museum, Brad? They're called a specific word.
That's a docent.
Yeah. A museum docent will take us around and we will laugh and talk and joke about Sparky's work. And I think it's going to be tremendous fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
As opposed to what you were on the Canterbury train, a dozer, this is a docent that takes you through.
I don't know why people say you enjoy wordplay. I don't know why you've earned that.
But that was not a pun.
I didn't say pun. I said wordplay. But anyway,
we have so many great things planned for that. It's going to be November. We're not sure of the date, right? It's going to be November 2022. So we've got lots of time to plan. But this is going to be something that we're really super excited about.
Yeah. So keep it in your back of your mind that you're going to come out to Santa Rosa, California in November 2022 as a Comic Lab listener. You're going to join Brad and I for a live taping of the show, which should be tremendous fun. That's going to be a hoot. Also, that auditorium at the museum, Brad, you haven't been there yet. That museum is top notch. But anyway, that auditorium is a super fun place to record a podcast. It's going to be great. We're going to do a gaggle, if you will, of Patreon listeners going around the museum together, which will be so fun. And then I personally think we should all go out and have a lovely glass of box wine together at a beer garden. Don't you think, Brad? Why not get Ernest and Julio out there with Brad Geiger and we're going to experience some of Brad's red water, and it's going to be delightful. I think it's going to be wonderful.
I think we absolutely should find some place to just kick back. If you remember, you talked about Baltimore Comic Con. One of the best memories I've got wasn't the convention itself. It was sitting in that hotel lobby with a bunch of cartoonists and just sitting there and everybody, you're just relaxing with the beverage of their choice. And we were passing sketchbooks around. I'm looking forward to maybe doing something very similar to that, where we can just all hang out with the Comic Lab folks and just enjoy having this common love of comics.
And you know what, Brad? I don't know why you and I both missed the low-hanging fruit. I don't know if everyone's familiar with this. Sparky grew up, it was a Michigan boy, right, Brad? Born and bred?
Was he?
Maybe Minnesota. It might have been Minnesota.
Minnesota,
yeah. Anyway, born and bred in the upper Midwest, and so loved hockey. Well, when you got Charles Schulz money, which is pretty considerable, you build your own ice skating rink right next to your studio in Santa Rosa, California. He built an ice skating rink. Speaking of heat, like Santa Rosa, not the coolest place in the world. So what we can also do, we can all go ice skating on Sparky's ice skating rink. Wouldn't that be fun, too?
Get I'd a cup love of coffee.
Because, as you know, there's a table that he used to write peanuts from right next to the ice skating rink. He would go over every morning, get a cup of coffee, sit in his specific table. There's a little plaque on the table. Sparky would write Peanuts here at this table. We can go ice skating together. I don't know. I think this is fun, Brad. You and I are going to hold hands, ice skating around the rink. We're going to sing little songs. It's going to be fun.
Make little figure eights.
Yeah, we're going to. You're going to hold me up, but I'm going to do the arms out, you know?
A pirouette.
As I'm singing, I Can Fly Higher Than the Eagles. That's going to be great. No, but honestly, keep it on your schedule for November 2022. Yeah. I also feel like what a nice thing to look forward to, hopefully, as the pandemic recedes. What a nice event that we're going to go celebrate. Yes. Sparky's 100th birthday. We'll have a live comic lab show. We're going to have a museum tour. We'll have something at a beer garden. We'll maybe go ice skating. It's going to be a really fun. And by the way, for those of you that might want to consider planning it as a family trip, for anyone that has a significant other, that kind of thing, it's really fun for wine country up there. That's mm-hmm. great fun too. So I really think it's going to be fun, and I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be awesome.
Well, fantastic. And as a matter of fact, I don't know that we've planned this out completely, but in terms of, we were just talking in the last two segments now about conventions and so forth. You had kind of a fun what if scenario for comic conventions. Do you want to talk about that now?
Well, yeah, because San Diego Comic-Con would have been, I believe, this past week that we've just gone through. And so now that's 2 years, Brad, with the largest Comic-Con in North America not happening. And obviously all the smaller ones not happening. But so my question to you, Brad, is this is just a thought experiment. What happens? What changes about the comics industry if they never come back? If we never do Comic-Cons again? That's obviously not going to happen, but it's an interesting thought experiment. What would happen in comics if we never did physical Comic-Cons again?
If comic conventions disappeared off the face of the earth, the average income, the average earnings of your mid-level garden variety independent cartoonist, right? People like you and me, people who are doing comics and doing them at a professional basis.
Okay.
The mid-level cartoonist would see their earnings rise by 10 to 20%.
I thought you were going to say that.
And I,
what
and
a
I
say, sticker.
And I believe it 100% because once they don't have that casino to walk into and gamble away their money and win a little bit 1 week and lose a whole lot the next week, and when they're not putting all of their time and effort on something that is absolutely proven to drain their bank accounts in most cases. If you're going to a convention and making money reliably, vaya con Dios. I'm going to argue very, very passionately that the garden variety cartoonist is not. And once they don't have that casino to show up at every week and they start turning to things that actually reliably make money, like Patreon and Kickstarter, their income would go up by 10 to 20%.
All I can do is laugh at that because I think it's a very Bradism to take that route to it. So you may be right. I personally have found the two or three shows after having done, I don't know, let's say two dozen Comic-Cons over the last 20 years, different Comic-Cons over the last 20 years. I found three that work for me that I can make a profit out of. And I just do those. I don't do it. I don't go to New York Comic Con because I know my expenses in New York. I can't do it. What all this to say is, so I don't necessarily discount what you're saying, that the average person at the average Comic Con, it's not working out so good. So I don't necessarily disagree with you on that. But I will say this. The older I get, the more that I think that Comic Cons for our industry serve as a coming together that generates heat and ideas and partnerships that you might never have connected to a Comic-Con, but much like a coffee shop in England in the 18th century or a salon in France in the 19th century, there are certain coming together that generate ideas, generate partnerships, generate projects. And I actually do think that Comic-Cons serve a purpose in, I wouldn't have met Brad Geiger Scott Kurtz wouldn't have met Chris Straub. You know, people that worked together, that made projects together, that didn't that wouldn't have happened had Comic-Cons not existed. You know what I mean? It's a form of a salon for a cartoonist, that the coming together of, hey, you're interesting. A lot of atoms bumping into each other. And sometimes those two atoms stick together and, oh, hey, a whole new molecule, that kind of thing, you know? And so for me, I think there we wouldn't notice it. Here's the thing. We wouldn't notice it because you don't miss absence, you know, future absence. We wouldn't notice it, but there would be projects that never would have happened or never would happen because Comic-Cons didn't exist.
No, that's a fair statement. I in fact, I would co-sign that. I wonder if this, to take this thought experiment to the next level, I wonder if there could ever be something that we take that gamble out of it and we replace it with something else. And the closest I can think of, even though I don't think I'm ever going to step foot on a cruise ship for a number of reasons, it just doesn't appeal to me. But like something where you get a whole lot of creative people in the same place at the same time, not with the idea of they're going to go and sell necessarily, but that they're going to go and almost less of a convention and more of a seminar, where you're going to go and have kind of similar to Patricon, where you go and you have a number of presentations and there's chances and opportunities to meet up with people. I wonder, I would love to see comic conventions replaced with something like that.
Well, you're going to immediately blanch when I say this, but in some respects, that is what the Reuben weekends are for the National Cartoonist Society. And look at, I knew you would blanch. I knew you would blanch immediately. Oh, Brad just threw up in his mouth. Is that they do seminars, it's a get together. I'm saying this as someone who has by choice not gone for the last 5 years or so. So that's my sort of, you know.
Well, we went together that 1 year, just a few years ago.
Oh,
right?
We did.
The one that
we
was
did.
At the beach.
Although, Brad, to be fair, we didn't go to anything. We just sold at the show. We didn't go to any of the events.
We did the convention, yeah.
We did the convention part to make money. We didn't go to any of the events. And so I think that's its own, listen, that's its own statement on what those are like.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm saying is that's a version of what you were just describing, mm-hmm. right? It's the idea that some cartoonists in the past decided, I don't want an event where I have to go sell. I want to just have an event where I go, I meet people, I talk, I hang out with friends in the industry, and I learn. That's a version of what the Reuben weekend was, if you're being generous.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I can't even fight you on that, but that's exactly what I'm talking about. That and Patricon, which I wonder if Patricon is ever coming back. In other words,
oh, I
we
wish
did
it
that.
Would. I wish it would. I know that they won't
it
do it,
so
and I understand
that
the reasons
one
why.
Year,
they,
that,
I know
that 1 year they did it was so good.
You and I, well, didn't you go out? And you and I went to two of them. And for those listening at home, Patricon was a physical in person event that Patreon held for, I don't know, about 200 to 300, I would say, high use Patreon creators. And boy, it was really pleasant, really great sharing of ideas. You and I learned, had immediate takeaways that we applied to our business like the next day, if not the next week.
I've still got this. I just picked this up off of my desk. What does it say? 2018 Patricon. I've got notes that I took at that Patricon that are still sitting right here on my desk. This wasn't a prop. This just happened to be here. I've still got notes that I referred to from that weekend.
Yeah, no, it's true. And so that it's funny. I wish we could have convinced them. We did talk to Patreon saying like, hey, can you please bring back Patricon? And they decided what they decided. And I understand why they wanted a more distributed online kind of event so that more people could experience something rather than 300 people experiencing something. Yeah. What I thought was incredible. But to each their own. I get it that they're trying to reach the largest possible people with the same amount of effort. And maybe Patricon didn't do that for anybody. Anyway, I don't know how we got on that topic. So Comic-Cons. So here's the thing, though. I don't know that some of these won't start disappearing anyway, because I don't know that DC and Marvel and are going to care that much about going to Midwest Tennessee Con 2023. You know, like, I don't know that that's going to be a thing going forward for them as far as priorities.
No, and I think they were already pulling out of a lot of those. But as we go further down the line, I think the people who own those companies who write the checks are just going to say, no, we're not doing that anymore. You know, it's just it's too much of a expense for a very little gain. And probably, you know, if they're smart, they do what Disney did. Disney got tired of showing up at other people's conventions, just started throwing its own convention. Now they do all of their own announcements at their own convention. That includes Marvel and Marvel Studios. It would be the smart thing to do for maybe DC as well, if they're going to continue to publish print comics into the coming years. And that's something we've discussed in the past.
It was a great page to take out of Apple's playbook, which is just create your own event. Don't go to the standard industry electronics event. Go to your own Apple event. You know, I liked it when I think Image did it once or twice. And I thought that was a fun idea, that Image has enough of a stable now where they could do their own. But anyway, I just thought it was a fun thought experiment to see what would change or what would be missing or how would we adapt if we lost Comic-Cons forever? And I, now having gone through 2 years, I was like, I could make it work. And this is someone who loves going to Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con. Yeah. But I could make it work. I it's an absence, yes, but you fill it in a different way, you know? And life finds, like the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, life finds a way, Brad, and we're finding our way through it. So, Brad, I've got exciting news for everyone who's been following along with your TikTok thirst trap videos. You've now got some big news. People really loving seeing Brad Geiger's thirst trap videos. What's the big event that's happening for you right now on TikTok?
To no one's surprise greater than my own, I have crossed my first major milestone. I have gained over 10,000 followers on TikTok in about 8 weeks of posting. I think that I've been doing this seriously for about 2 months now. Now let's see. Oh, 4/23. So the April, that's end of April is when I started doing this seriously on TikTok. So you've got May and June. Yeah, 2 months. So in a little over 2 months, I crossed over 10,000 followers, making TikTok at this point my top social media. I've been on Twitter since, I forget, going back to the very beginning, and I've got about 5,000 there. I've been on Instagram for years, and I think it's up to maybe 3 dozen followers on Instagram. Facebook is a non-contender unless you're going to pay for ads, so I don't even really take that seriously anymore. TikTok is now my number one top outreach for social media. And it's just to know what it perplexes me, but there you go. It's the best success I've had.
Well, I sniff at TikTok for a whole bunch of reasons, but I can't sniff at the fact that in 2 months you have gotten to a higher. 15 years I've been plowing the field at Twitter, and or maybe that's not the best phrase to use. I've been doing the work on Twitter, and I've yet to crack 10,000 on Twitter. Instagram for me is at, I don't know, 46,000, 45,000, but is useless. Instagram is useless. But TikTok, 10,000 people in 2 months, that's not nothing. Here's my remaining critique, though. I don't know what that and a dollar will get you a dollar. I don't know what TikTok is going to get you, per se. You know,
I know.
Anyone I know that's making money on TikTok is paying them to do the thing, or more rarely a sponsor is doing it. But like, there's no linking out. There's no benefit to the creator from TikTok, much like Instagram. And eventually that sponsorship money is going to dry up for people as TikTok reaches their growth numbers that they want to get to, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like if you were living with Snow White and you found out that you're the tallest of all the 7 dwarves. It's an achievement. I just don't know whether it's going to mean anything in the long run. But it's worth noting, it's worth talking about, that this is absolutely the most traction that I've ever gotten on social media.
Well, this tells us a couple of things. One, what sex appeal Brad Geiger must have. Even the videos where it's like a shirt with a tiny little bit of pasta sauce on it, Brad is still racking up the views.
Well, that's it. You know what? I think that kind of makes me more relatable. It's like, yeah, sure, this guy can't hit his mouth, but he might know a little something about Patreon. You know, he's not so distracted by hair care that he hasn't taken the time to learn good typography.
I love that as a friend, you're like, hey, Dave, what did you think of my most recent TikTok video? And my immediate comment was not like, oh, I love the commentary on art, or oh, I really appreciated the way you presented that idea. My immediate thought was like, oh, boy, you must have loved that shawarma. That must have been. That shawarma must have been delightful. By the way, my phone just rang, which is the first time that's ever happened to me in the podcast. Who calls during, don't leave me alone during my podcast. I've turned my phone off now.
Don't you know it's podcast time?
Don't you know it's podcast time? But anyway, here's the thing. I'm saying this criticism about TikTok because it is, I'm saying physician heal thyself in terms of my own use of Instagram. I wanted to build up Instagram, got it up to 10,000 so that I could link out of stories. Now it's up to 46,000, and I just kind of have let it stalled out because the links out of Instagram don't get you a damn thing. No one supports it. Like, Instagram is not a format that supports a career, even in the same way that Twitter does. I would much rather have, I don't know, 5,000 dedicated Twitter followers than 50,000 Instagram followers, because they don't do a damn thing. And so that's what I'm concerned about with TikTok, which, aside from maybe sponsorship money from TikTok, or aside from maybe the occasional sponsorship, you know, from a third party via TikTok, I don't know how Brad Geiger is going to make this work for you, you know?
Neither do I. And I'll even tell on myself, because I've got no problems telling on myself in this respect. This will be the fourth or fifth time that we've talked about this topic on the show where I say, I'm going to run an experiment and find out whether they follow a link. I'm going to do an ebook at 50%, or I'm going to do this. I haven't done it partially because I'm scared of the answer. I don't want to know the answer. I want, right now, I'm very happy in my own little fantasy. Eventually, I'm going to have to pull the trigger and find out just how useful a link can be. But I'm scared of what the answer is going to be.
I will tell you, I will tell on myself, because this is important for other people to hear this. The reason why I have not given up on Instagram is pure ego at this point. I'm like, oh, I sure do like having 46,000 followers on Instagram, even though they don't give me a damn thing. Like, when there's a Kickstarter, I can track where people are coming from. It'll be like one person from Instagram. On Shopify, I can track where people are coming from for a sale or something. Instagram sends you a dead moth. That's all you get, you know? And like, you don't get anything out of Instagram. And so my fear is TikTok is going to be more of the same, where I feel like this is going to be a lot of us running in place to benefit a social media company where we as cartoonists are not getting anything out of it, you know? That's my fear. So while I'm happy for me that I got 46 on Instagram, happy for you that you got 10,000 on TikTok, I don't know what we get from that. You know, it's a lot of fireworks that don't generate any heat. I don't know.
Although I will say this, if you're listening right now and you discovered Comic Lab through TikTok, by all means, let us know.
Yes. Oh, dear God. Tell us. Let us know.
Tell us. We did pick up a Patreon backer just this week through TikTok. I will say that. But that's very, again, it's very anecdotal, and it's only one out of, you know, how many. So, but if you are listening because you discovered us on TikTok, that would be wonderful for us to know. In the meantime, Dave, do you think we've got time for one more Patreon question?
We absolutely do, my friend.
All right. Then I've got one that I think this is rather straightforward. This comes in from Son of Wits, who says, hi, Brad and Dave. I've been having a blast listening to the show since discovering it recently. Perhaps maybe on TikTok. One never knows.
one can hope. One can hope.
This is a simple question that has likely been asked before. Do either of you prepare web and print versions of your comics text with different font sizes for screen and print? Or do you know if this is standard practice? Thanks. So, Dave, different font sizes, one for print, one for web. Is that something that you do or would advocate or could see the benefit of?
I would not advocate, no, nor do I necessarily see the benefit of, mainly for workflow and administration. Like you would be doing double the work for, I think, not very much benefit. I think in an ideal world, the presentation of your comic on the web would be of a size and ratio that is within 20-30% of how it would appear in print. Does that make sense, Brad? Like,
yes, it
shouldn't
it
be so
yes,
worlds
does.
Of different. Like, you don't want one of those, you know, those art books that the, what's the guy, the German guy, Taschen, you know, those art books that are like 40 inches wide by 60 inches high. It's not like you're producing print comics that are going to go into a Taschen book. They're going to go into a standard 8x8, 8x10, whatever the, you know, ratio is going to be book. And so in an ideal world, that comic should read roughly the same as a comic that is 1200 pixels wide or 1500 pixels wide or 1000 pixels wide. You get where I'm going with this, is that it should be in the same ballpark. So I don't know that I would ever advocate or give a blessing to creating two different font sizes for two different outlets. Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, I'll say the exact same thing, only a little bit different. If your lettering isn't big enough to be read in either one of those circumstances, it needs to get bigger. In other words, there's no accounting for that. If it's not big enough on the web, it's probably not big enough in print, and vice versa. It's got to be big enough to be read in both. There's just no way around it. And I think also here's something, and that is, these days on the web, I'm very much an advocate that in every opportunity you have, you should be posting your comic as a vertical scroll, which means panel by panel. And in that case, that's going to instantaneously address any lettering issues, because that lettering is going to be pretty big at that point. There are some cases where you just can't, like Twitter, because of the they only let you post so many images, which is really, in this day and age, hard for me to get my head around, but there you go. It's very difficult to do that on Twitter, but you can do that on your own website. You can absolutely do that in most cases on Instagram. There's lots of ways you can do that. You should be posting that comic on a vertical scroll, because these days, particularly more and more, and probably, I think it's safe to say, although I haven't checked it recently, we've crossed over the tipping point where the majority of people on the web are accessing it through their phones and other smaller handheld devices. This is something that, if you haven't made that switch, you're way late at this point. This is something we've been talking about for a long time, and the time is now. You should be posting on a vertical scroll. When you do, that lettering issue that you're worried about is going to take care of itself.
So I'm going to tackle this from a slightly different direction than Brad did. I think Brad's advice is spot on, which is, I would advise creating and sizing up your lettering for print first, and then work backwards, whether you do a vertical, whether you do some sort of page layout, then figure out what web display you're going to create for your comics that works with the final print version. This might be just a six in one, half dozen the other for the way Brad described. But I think designing for print first and then working backwards is in a lot of respects for comic creation the way you want to go, in terms of setting up colors, in terms of setting up files, in terms of setting up lettering and character heights and all that sort of stuff. I think that's a great way to go. So I think it's a really interesting question, though, because I could see, like Brad, my suspicion is that you need to think more or rework your lettering if this is an issue. I think the very fact that this is coming up for you as a question makes me go, something might be wrong here. Some form of lettering is not sizing right one for the other, because you're widely off the mark on where you should be for your lettering sizes. Yeah. And I think, honestly, a really low tech solution that you can do very easily, one is to physically print out your favorite comic in whatever genre you're working in or format you're working in. If you're a graphic novel, an image comic, or a comic strip, a web comic, whatever it is, print it out and see at your size of drawing what would that lettering have to be. Right. Another version of that is just grab the JPEG off the internet, drag it into Photoshop, bring it to the size that you draw at, and see what that lettering would be at the size that you're creating your files. Right. A really low tech solution to a somewhat tricky problem, and I think you'll be right as rain within an hour of doing it.
Absolutely. And speaking of Rightus Rain, there's another thing that's right, and that's the fact that you've been listening to Comic Lab, which, let's face it, couldn't be wrong. This is the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been my friend Brad Geiger, who is always on time for a train. He's the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my good friend Dave, thinking outside of the box of Wine Kellett, co-director of the comics documentary strip.
I didn't see it coming. That got me.
Co-director of the comics directory. I'll try that again.
You started, well, hold on. You started doing that 1950s comedian thing of like, co-director of the comics strip documentary. You said box wine and immediately your body had a Friday night response.
That was a Forrest Brooks take. Co-director of Stripped. The comics documentary, and let me get through this, and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com. Check out, if you, in case there's still time, check out his Kickstarter over at drivekickstarter.com.
Or actually, I'm using newdrivebook.com this time. Although I think I also have Drive Kickstarter as a redirect. So you're good. You're a wonderful person. Everybody likes you. Yeah, exactly. And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode and all episodes was edited by our friend Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media. And of course, we got to give a shout out and a thank you to our sponsor for this week, the good folks at Wacom at WACOM.com. Wacom.com, the makers of the new Wacom One.
And if you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode like this one, Dave. This is a 5-star review that came in from Cup of Joe 2012. The headline is, "Yes, this is the show you're looking for." Listen to this. "I discovered this podcast just a few weeks ago and was hooked from my first episode. Brad and Dave are not just walking the walk of 21st century working cartoonists. They're talking the talk, and they're a blast to listen to. Inspiration, validation, tough love, and best of all, extremely timely and targeted advice, plus a healthy dose of good humor and fun, make this the perfect listen for any cartoonist, whether full-time or just getting started. I listen while I draw, and I feel like I've found my group. Along with the cartooning advice is a laudable example of kindness, consideration, and friendship. Thanks for the great show, guys."
Wow, you did not read that to me before the show. That I'm genuinely taken aback by that. That's really lovely.
I just wanted to drop that on you. That was a delightful way. I think I just saw that earlier this week, but it was like during my morning stroll over a cup of coffee, and it was such a nice way to wake up.
I got to tell you, I want to really thank Brad's mom for taking a moment to log into Apple Podcasts and make that really nice post. No, in all seriousness, Cup of Joe, thank you for that. Thank you for that really nice write-up. I'm always touched by how much, Brad, the friendship comes through on the show. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. I think that's sweet.
It's a very human response. And people are like, you know what? I just like listening to two friends have fun with each other. There's worse things in life. Anyway, I'm going to say Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/comiclab. God, it's kind of true. There were like 3 TikToks in a row. Brad, there were like 3 TikToks in a row where it's like, okay, that's a little korma. That's a little spaghetti sauce. That's how, oh, there we go. There's some coffee that was spilled.
I now have 5 t-shirts in the corner that I just wear for TikToks now because I realized I don't notice it until I shot the video. And it's like, oh, fuck it. They're not going to notice it on TikTok. It's low resolution. There's going to be words. Nobody's looking that close.
I realize how long suffering my wife is sometimes, because every once in a while I'll see myself in a picture and I'm like, good God, this is how I roll through the day. Cause I'm a cartoonist. I don't need to dress up for anybody. She is a professional Hollywood showrunner and producer, and she's got to take meetings with big wigs all the time and always looks lovely. And I look like I just rolled out of a trailer park. I'm like, all right, time to create some cartoons. All right, let's see what I got here. Oh, here's a free t-shirt I got from a Comic-Con 8 years ago. This'll do. This is fine by dummy. So I get it with the TikToks. I see why you have a shawarma stain on your shirt. I'm the same guy. I'm not judging. I am not judging.
I actually bought a bunch of those dad bod t-shirts just because I needed, because I think just about everything I own has some spot somewhere, because who cares, you know? So I had to buy stuff that was new, so I didn't have a chance to eat in it yet. And now I do nothing but I put it on, I shoot, and then I take it off.
It's the only way to assure this. Suddenly, by the way, just by nature of Brad being Brad, you're going to end up with like Lucky Charm stains on your shirt. You're like, how did this get here? I only wear it to record TikToks.
Yeah, no kidding.